greater than ourselves could restore us to sanity. Three made the decision to turn our will and our lives over to the care of God as we understood them. Four made a searching and fearless moral inventory of ourselves. Admitted to God, to ourselves, and to another human being the exact nature of our wrongs. Six, we're entirely ready to have God remove all these defects of character. Seven, humbly asked him to remove our shortcomings. Eight, made a list of all persons we had harmed and became willing to make amends to them. Nine, made direct amends to such people wherever possible, except when to do so would injure them or others. 10, continued to take personal inventory, and when we were wrong, promptly admitted it. 11, sought through prayer and meditation to improve our conscious contact with God as we understood him, praying only for knowledge of his will for us and the power to carry that out. 12, having had a spiritual awakening as a result of these steps, we tried to carry this message to alcoholics and to practice these principles in all our affairs.
Thank you, Bill. Tonight is anniversary night, and as such, we will be honoring our celebrants at the start of the meeting. Tonight, we have two celebrants. I just lost my place. Would the celebrants please join me up front? We take this time each month to recognize group members as they mark milestones in their sobriety. It is our belief that pausing in gratitude for these milestones provides hope and inspiration and also fosters love and support for one another. We do ask everyone to keep in mind the number of celebrants and the end time of the meeting. It is the group's conscience that celebrants limit their shares to a minute or so. And now, please join me in singing. Happy anniversary to you. Happy anniversary to you. Happy anniversary, dear celebrants. Happy anniversary. Okay. Thanks, everyone, for singing. Tonight, our first celebrant is Ramiro with 6 years.
Thank you, Amanda. Hi, Ramiro Alcoholic. I guess I'm holding this correctly. I don't know what to say other than thank you. 6 years ago, I walked into the meeting for the Beacon Group the first time in the basement of, I think it was United Parish, and I came in the wrong way. Some of you remember and know this. I came in the wrong way through the church and through the exit part of the church. I think I finally found out that the meeting was in the basement, so I entered through the first door, the window, or the boiler room or something, and I went into the meeting for the first time the wrong way. Right, and I was walking around trying to figure out if I was going to stay or not, and I was looking at the ceiling. I remember that, trying to figure out if I was in the right place, and Michaela, some of you remember, came over and introduced herself to me, right, as I was getting ready to walk out the room, right, and so I've been here for 6 years. Thanks again for my sobriety. Thanks for letting me be of service, and thanks again for providing me and others a space here. Thanks.
Okay. Next up, we have Bill with 31 years.
Thanks, Amanda. Hi, I'm Bill. I'm an alcoholic. I've just found the Beacon Group actually through, the conference that we had a year ago at MIT. And I also knew Arisa from another group. But over my 31 years, I have been in and out of the program. I had the unfortunate consequence of coming to meetings but not doing any of the work, and then stopping and realizing that that was the only thing I needed to do, and living a crazy life for another 15 years, and coming back and doing what it says here, how it works. I don't know, scary stuff to look at yourself. It's especially for me to trust another guy, and you know, the shame and whatever that I was going to take to my grave. Fortunately, people listened and didn't turn me in. So it's a great honor to be here because of the program and all I can say is, like, you know, you could be here and continue to learn, which is great. It's not about white knuckling it. I don't really think about drinking. I just learned stuff, and that includes from people who are new and from reading this book. And the only downside of that is realizing how little I knew and how positive I was about it years before. So hopefully may you continue to learn and refine your program and help people. Thank you.
Congratulations again to both of our celebrants. Because of tonight's celebration, the format of tonight's meeting is only one 10-minute speaker followed by our main speaker, who will speak for 30 minutes. All of our meetings are recorded and accessible on our website, beacongroupaa.com. We support AA's statements of unity and anonymity and therefore ask all our speakers to identify by first name only and to refrain from using profanity. Tonight, our 10-minute speaker is Hannah.
Hi, I'm Hannah. I'm an alcoholic.
Hi, Hannah.
I'm very grateful to be here. My sobriety date is December 24th, 2022. My home group is out of the basement, which I joined like a month ago. To qualify, I started, the first time I drank, I was 12 years old, and the first time I drank, I had the obsession to drink more. I only had one Bud Light, but I obsessed for like the rest of the night why my friend didn't get us another one. And that obsession to drink more, like, just continued for the rest of my drinking career, pretty much. I made it through like middle school and high school kind of drinking normally. I mean, I always drank like probably the most out of my friends, but not enough that like anyone really, no one in my life like called me out for it. I studied abroad my freshman year of college, and that was the first time I drank by myself for like no reason at all. I was in Spain, and I realized I could just buy sangria and drink it while I did my homework. So I started doing that like every night. And I didn't really see an issue with it, but it was at the same time that, like, I started to develop really debilitating depression, too. And I was supposed to be in Spain for a year. I came back 6 months early because I just couldn't. I was just, like, so depressed that I didn't want to be so far away from my family. So I came home, didn't really drink that much for, like, another 8 months. I transferred schools and I started drinking again for no reason at all. I like can remember the day that I had a feeling I was crossing over the line. I was like at my campus and everybody had gone home for a long weekend, and I got drunk by myself and walked around campus, and it was like a great time. Like, I had so much fun doing that, that I started doing it like all the time. Like, I started going to class drunk, I started going to work drunk, I started driving, and it just got worse and worse, and the worst, like, my alcoholism got was I did van life, and I moved out to California, and, you know, everybody at home, I think, thought that I was, like, living this, or I was, like, on this awesome adventure, and I was, like, launching my life, and it was, like, so awesome, but really what it looked like was like I was blacked out alone in like Walmart parking lots for like 3 months, and nobody knew except for me. And I knew that like I wanted to stop, but I didn't know how. I would like log on to Zoom AA, and I would listen and like try to stay sober. Sometimes I would ask someone to sponsor me like in the chat, and then I would like never follow up with them. But I knew that, like, eventually I was going to have to stop drinking. I just still couldn't really figure out how. So I ended up moving to California, continued drinking. I was just blacking out all the time in my apartment by myself and not talking to anyone for like days. And when I was talking to people, it was usually talking to my family over text message and just like going on incoherent rants towards them and just causing fights. And I just was very like isolated and alone. And it got to the point where I really was like, either whenever I was awake, I was drunk and I would just like drink until I fell asleep. And like, I just wanted to be asleep all the time. And in the end, you know, I had like taped paper all over the mirrors in my apartment. Like I just couldn't even look at myself anymore. It was like, when I think about it, like it was too much for me to stand up. Like I couldn't even get out of bed and like open my eyes and stand up straight because I couldn't face like what my life had become so quickly. Like it just, I just felt like such a piece of dirt basically. And so I decided that I was probably going to kill myself. And I was staying at my brother's apartment. He lived in a building that you could jump off of, I concluded. And that was my plan. So I like spent a few days going back and forth about that. And like, I have suicide in my family and I didn't want to do that to my family, but I also didn't know what else to do. But like, that was like the moment where I felt like there was maybe a chance that like things could change. Like maybe I could get sober one day and be decent. Like maybe that could happen to me. So I called my parents and they got me back to Massachusetts and they wanted me to wait 3 weeks to get back to Massachusetts. And I could not do that. That was like the worst thing I ever heard. I was like, I'm not going to make it a day more. So, I got on a plane the next day and that was my first time going to treatment. And I went to treatment, I think a total of 5 more times within the next 7 months. And I learned something every time, but the obsession was like just still there for me. Until the very end, I got sent down to Florida, which is where I got sober. And the last time I drank, I was blacked out in the Target bathroom. And that was like, you know, like I just had a moment where I was just, I wasn't even like, okay, I'm done drinking or I'm going to get sober. Like it was just like, I just will try whatever people tell me to do. Like, I don't know what to do anymore. So, that program was very heavy on 12 steps. So I wrote a 4-step there and learned a lot. And I got out and found a sponsor and she made me restart all the steps. So I rewrote a 4-step, did a 5th step, started making my amends. The first amends I made were to people that I was in treatment with that I was mean to. And I've just kind of taken suggestions since then. I mean, I still pretty much just like try to copy people with more sobriety than me. I still like don't really know how to do a lot of things. Like things come up with my family or with work or with AA and I have no idea what to do, but I have people that I can call and ask like, what would you do? And I do that still pretty much every day. You know, like I was super nervous to speak tonight, so I just called my sponsor and I'm like, what should I do? What should I talk about? Like, and she just told me to be honest. So that's what I am doing. But yeah, I'm just so grateful for AA. I'm so grateful that I got lucky and found someone who like really took me through the book the way that it's laid out. And, you know, like I don't, obviously my sponsor isn't God. She didn't get me sober, but she really did teach me the way and I just did what she said and I'm still sober today. And I plan on just keep coming back. Today I sponsor other women. I write a lot of inventory recently. And I think that's pretty much it, but I'm very grateful to be here and congratulations to the celebrants and thank you for having me.
Thank you, Hannah. We will now observe the seventh tradition. AA has no dues or fees for AA membership, but we do have expenses. The seventh tradition states every AA group ought to be fully self-supporting, declining outside contributions. While contributions cover each group's expenses, the seventh tradition is essential at every level of AA service. Since the start of the... this is really old. AA's usual suggestion is a $2 contribution per meeting. We are passing the basket, but you may also observe the seventh tradition digitally on Venmo. There is a QR code in the basket, and our Venmo handle is @beacon-group. Again, although there are no dues or fees for AA membership, we do have expenses. Our rent is $200 per month. Please give what you can and see our treasurer, Megan, with any questions. We thank you in advance for your generosity. AA also has a set of traditions which apply to the group in the same manner that the 12 steps apply to the individual. Tonight, Lily has been asked to read the 12 traditions.
Hi, I'm Lily. I'm an alcoholic.
Hello.
Read me. Okay. Here are the 12 traditions. 1. Our common welfare should come first. Personal recovery depends on AA unity. 2. For our group purpose, there is but one ultimate authority, a loving God as he may express himself in our group conscience. Our leaders are but trusted servants. They do not govern. 3. The only requirement for AA membership is a desire to stop drinking. 4. Each group should be autonomous, except in matters affecting other groups or AA as a whole. 5. Each group has but one primary purpose, to carry its message to the alcoholic who still suffers. 6. An AA group ought never endorse. I thought that said overdose. An AA group ought never endorse, finance, or lend the AA name to any related facility or other enterprise, lest problems of money, property, and prestige divert us from our primary purpose. 7. Every AA group ought to be fully self-supporting, declining outside contributions. 8. Alcoholics Anonymous should remain forever non-professional, but our service centers may employ special workers. 9. AA, as such, ought never be organized, but we may create service boards or committees directly responsible to those they serve. 10. Alcoholics Anonymous has no opinion on outside issues, hence the AA name ought never be drawn into public controversy. 11. Our public relations policy is based on attraction rather than promotion. We need always maintain personal anonymity at the level of press, radio, and film. And 12. Anonymity is the spiritual foundation of all our traditions, ever reminding us to place principles before personalities.
Thank you, Lily. Beacon Group is run by a business meeting which meets on the third Wednesday of each month immediately following the speaker meeting, both here at Temple Beth Zion and online. This is your opportunity to get more involved. All group members are encouraged to attend and participate. We hope you can join us. Will all group members please raise their hands? And now let's welcome our main speaker, Kanan.
Hey everybody, my name's Kanan. I'm an alcoholic. And I'm grateful to be here with you guys tonight, even though it hasn't felt like that all day. And I'll give you guys the disclaimer. It has been a week and a half, and especially a day today. Hopefully it's one of those nights where you're probably either going to get the best that I got or the worst that I got. So, hang in there either way. So thank you, Amanda and Joe, for asking me out here. Congratulations on the anniversaries tonight. And Hannah, you did great. It was awesome to hear you. Thank you for your honesty. Amanda and Joe asked me to speak here about a month ago, probably, of course, I did what I always do and told myself, I probably don't want to go down there, but then I said yes, And no, to be honest, I was excited to come out here. I'd never been to this meeting before. I know that, you know, obviously you guys are kind of an old school speaker style meeting. And yeah, I was excited to do it. You know, God's plan doesn't always align with mine. And sometimes it is tough for me to even wrap my head around, you know, or, you know, see, you know, why it's going the way it is. So a week and a half ago, a good friend, and I'm just going to get the elephant out of the room right away. A good friend of mine, a good friend of ours, her name's Kara, passed away unexpectedly. And, you know, I hadn't really thought about this commitment up to that point. You know, spent the week kind of dealing with those things and helping the family and our friends and whatnot. Then we find out the services are going to be Wednesday, today. You know, again, I hadn't even thought about this meeting, to be honest with you, and how it lined up with the services, until Joe reached out to me and was like, "Hey, are you still going to be all right, you know, to come out to Beacon on Wednesday?" And again, my first instinct was, no, I'm not going to be all right. That's the last place I want to be. You know, I know we got a full day. We've got a full morning of services, a full mass. We've got a, you know, reception afterwards. But again, you know, my first thought always isn't the best one. And over the years, I've been taught that and understand that. And, you know, God and, you know, usually through the people around me jumps in at some point. And, yeah, it became clear this is exactly where I need to be on a night like today. You know, this is exactly where Kara would want me to be on a night like tonight. You know, is here with you guys talking about how AA gave me everything that I have in life. You know, about how Alcoholics Anonymous took this, you know, complete mess of a kid and turned him into, you know, a reasonably functioning adult with people that I love and love me more than I ever could have comprehended before, you know, and she was one of them. And, you know, today was hard. Last week was hard. But one thing that I've also got to see a lot over the years, and I've got to see today in the last week, is Alcoholics Anonymous rally, you know, rally around their own, show up for their people, you know, us show up for each other. And that's what the last week's been full of, you know, and it's hard at times to take away the good, you know, or see it, or see God's plan in moments like these. But again, something I've learned here over the years is that there always is one, you know. And sometimes it doesn't line up with mine, but it's there, you know. And I don't know. I owe Alcoholics Anonymous everything. And, you know, to watch you guys show up and rally around each other is, you know, there's nothing like it. And I've never seen it anywhere else. So, yeah, that's that. And I'll probably get soppy again at some point down the road, probably around minute 23. But let's move on. So my sobriety date, I got one of those. It is August 27th of 2012. I do have a home group. It's the North Reading Young People's Group. We meet Thursdays at 8:30. Come out tomorrow. Yeah, I have a sponsor as well. And these are all things, that I was told to get right off the jump. And again, I think are things that, you know, I think are important to say, you know, especially years down the road, because, there's been points along the way, you know, over the last 11 years, the only thing I've had 100% of the time is my sobriety date, you know, there hasn't been huge long stints of missing the other two, but there has been times where, you know, procrastinate getting a new sponsor, schedule changes, you know, have trouble or don't put enough effort in finding a new home group, you know. And one of the things I've learned is keeping it simple with those three things. When I can do that, you know, my sobriety, my life stays, you know, steadier. So, yeah. Yeah. What it was like. I am, you know, from, you know, I came down, I was down here all day, but I live in Manchester, New Hampshire. And I'm from there. I'm the oldest of six kids. I was raised, you know, knowing right from wrong. Is the simplest way I like to put it. You know, my household was chaotic, a lot of kids, you know. My mother's a saint, my father, you know, likes to party. But a good dad, you know, showed up for his kids, provided for his family. And that's what my family is full of, you know. Irish guys that like to party hard, but show up and go to work and provide for their families and, you know, show up for life, you know. And right off the bat, it showed that for me that was going to be a problem, the whole showing up part. Yeah, my first drink, I was 12. My dad was, you know, having one of his parties, had some of his buddies over. I know it was in the middle of the week. I can't remember what day. And I finally worked up the courage to go upstairs and steal a few of his Budweisers out of the fridge. I've been thinking about it for months. You know, I finally worked up the strength and the courage, and I went up there. I did it. I brought him down to my room. I choked down about 2.5. You know, tasted terrible. Hated it. Hated that part. Loved the feeling that it gave me, though. And I didn't get pass out, piss your pants, throw up on mom drunk. You know, what it did for me was it solved a problem that I didn't know I had. You know, and a lot of times, you know, people use the square peg, round hole sort of analogy. I had that, you know, I like to say, you know, it was like I didn't know what to do with my hands all the time. You know, it was like I constantly, and I didn't recognize it back then. I had no clue. I didn't learn any of this until I got here and I heard you guys share your experience and I could finally go, yeah, that's what was going on. But yeah, it was like I never knew what to do with my hands. You know, do I put them in my pockets? Do I hold them on my sides? Do I cross them? Do I put them by? You know, it's like never know. Constantly shifty and fidgety and uncomfortable. And it was like once I got a couple of those things down, it was, you know, my hands can just sit here. Yeah. It's cool. You know, that ease and comfort that I didn't know I needed came over me, and I knew that I wanted to catch that feeling as often as I could. And immediately that's what I started to do. Yeah, so things escalated quickly for me. You know, I like to also say that I had, you know, when I got to Alcoholics Anonymous and I started working with a sponsor, I started hearing terms like psychic change and spiritual experience and these sorts of things. And, you know, as we were reading, my sponsor explained to me, and we read out a spiritual experience, that a psychic change or a spiritual experience is a complete shift in the way that I think, the way that I react, the way that I view life. And that through the work here, I would get one of those. And I have, thank God. But also, when I started drinking, it was also like I had a psychic change. You know, like I said, I grew up with morals, with, you know, simple things, nothing crazy, right? You don't steal, you don't hurt people, you go to school, you know, simple shit like that. And, you know, it was like immediately all that's out the window. You know, right off the bat, like I said earlier, I'm the oldest of six kids, and I took a lot of pride in that. You know, I liked being a big brother, I liked showing up for them, I liked, you know, kind of being an example and a leader for them. And it was like immediately out the window. I was never the best in school, but I got by, you know, immediately getting in trouble, immediately, you know, skipping classes, and then, you know, dropped out by the time I'm 16. You know, almost immediately in trouble with the cops, probation when I'm 15, you know, it's like, all this stuff, you know, immediately the problem child at home, you know, and that wasn't the case before. It's like all these things changed immediately because my family, my school, you know, hockey was getting in the way of my drinking. And again, not that I would have known that at the time, but that's what it was. And my life from that point on was a constant, you know, it was a revolving door of like, you know, you get in the way of my drinking, I'm going to run you over. Doesn't matter who you are, or what's going on, that's going to come first. So, like I said, by the time I'm in high school, my life is already starting to fall apart. You know, I'm barely showing up for school, constantly in trouble when I'm there. You know, by the time I was 15, like I said, on probation, I spent long periods of time, you know, living in the middle of Manchester. We kind of lived on the outskirts, but I would disappear for days to this 35-year-old woman's house with six kids. And I would just sleep there until eventually I decided to go home. Yeah, what that proceeded to, and at first, you know, at first it was like, attractive to me almost, I guess. This other life, it's what I want. I have a funny story actually. So I was probably, you know, 16-ish, and I found myself, you know, some would say homeless because I didn't have, because my parents wouldn't let me back and I didn't have an apartment. but, you know, I found myself at the Econo Lodge, downtown Manchester, and, I'm there with a, you know, fellow drug dealing buddy of mine and, you know, two girls that, you know, didn't give a shit about us. you know, I remember we got a room and we go upstairs and, I open the door. I take a pull off this bottle of Scoresby's whiskey. I lay down on the bed. I light a Marlboro Red. And I think, this is it. It can't get any better than this. You know, I have arrived. And the truth is, it truly did not get any better than that for me until I got here a few years later. You know, from that point on, it looked like a constant mess of, you know, getting kicked out of my parents' house, you know, rolling around, finding places to crash, you know, kissing up to them, working my way back, shaking it out, sweating it out on my mom's couch every couple months. That was my move. You know, things will get back. I'd need her to take me back. I'd say, you know, I'll sweat it out on your couch. She'd let me. I'd get in their good graces for a little bit, get kicked out. You know, the trouble with the law started to get worse, as it does. you know, I found myself in a youth rehab/detention center when I was 16, turning 17. You know, and again, I got my license at 16. I got arrested for a DUI when I was 16 and a quarter. I didn't see my license again until, wow, that was fast, huh? Jesus. You know, until I got here, until I was 21. So I'll get to the end because I've talked about getting drunk for too long. What it looked like at the end was me, 19 years old, with seeing no way out. You know, I woke up every day telling myself I was not going to do it again. I'd do it again, and then I spent the remainder of the day daydreaming about robbing banks, because that was my way out. You know, I wasn't dying fast enough. I wasn't going to prison fast enough. I knew that if I robbed a bank, I'd probably get caught at some point, and I'd end up in prison like everyone else I knew was. So let it be. But what happened was God intervened, you know. And again, couldn't see it at the time. I'd been trying to get into treatment for, you know, a little while, and nowhere would take my insurance. It was, you know, it seems like it was a little more difficult back then than it is now. I had an aunt that I didn't know. She was estranged from the family since I was a kid. I had never met her, but she had gotten sober a few years prior, I guess, and came back into my father's life and told him, you know, or he must have told her about what was going on with me. And she told him I can get Kanan into treatment down in Naples, Florida. I also got sober in Florida. But he's got to get on a plane tomorrow and get down here. So my mom told me, you know, what was up. She said, you got to get on a plane tomorrow and go down there. I said, that's fine. I'll do that. Give me $40 and I'll be here in the morning. Which was the move, right? She said, absolutely not, which wasn't her usual response, honestly. You know, normally she would have given me the $40 because she thought it would get me on that plane. You know, and that's all she wanted. But she said, absolutely not. You can stay here and I'll bring you in the morning, or you can be gone. And for some reason, I stayed. I got on that plane and, you know, my life shifted from that point on. I got down to Florida after a horrendous plane ride. The Hand of Alcoholics Anonymous was there for me right away before I even understood one bit what Alcoholics Anonymous was. Like I said, my aunt had gotten sober. She told me some lady was coming to pick me up at the airport. It turned out that lady was her sponsor. She called me. I said, yeah, I'm standing outside the terminal. I'm wearing, you know, old Jordan shorts with burn holes in them. I look like shit. And she found me right away. That woman brought me to rehab on her lunch break. You know, she drove 40 minutes to come and get me at the airport and bring me back to the treatment center that I was going to. And at the time, you know, I was wondering the whole way down why this lady was being so nice to me, you know, why she offered to buy me Chick-fil-A, you know, when I clearly had nothing to offer, you know, and obviously as time goes on and as the years went on, you know, I learned to understand what that was all about. I got into treatment, and they did the best thing I think you can do for an alcoholic, and that was they introduced me to Alcoholics Anonymous. And they told me to get a sponsor, and they told me to get a home group, and they told me to get numbers. They would take me out to meetings, or take us out to meetings almost every night. You know, for some reason, I listened for the most part. You know, I was the guy that knows when I got here, too. You know, they would tell me things, and I'd be like, yeah, I know. They'd be like, oh, you should, you know, you should get that guy's number. Yeah, yeah, I know. You know, and it's like, I didn't know anything, but I tell you, I knew everything. I asked this guy to be my sponsor. He got up. It was actually a meeting just like this one. They had a 10-minute speaker and a 30-minute speaker. He was the 10-minute speaker. He was a little Puerto Rican kid from New York on the outside. He looked completely different than me, but he got up there to the podium, and he spoke a story very similar to mine, but what he did more importantly was he portrayed this, like, just ease, you know, this peace, this, you know, this feeling of just being okay. And again, I remember seeing that, and I saw it one time before when I was in detox, this guy came in to speak. And it was like, it brought up this thing that I never knew I had again. You know, it was like, he got up there and it was so clear that he didn't give a shit what anyone in the audience was thinking of him, you know? And I had never felt that before in my life, you know? I had never felt okay. I had never felt comfortable. I had never been, you know, I would act confident, but I wasn't, And he got up there, and I remember thinking, you know, I want that. I want to feel that. So I asked him to be my sponsor, and he immediately started taking me through the work. You know, and he told me to read the doctor's opinion. I did that. I called him the next day. I was still in treatment. He told me to read it again. I did that. I called him. He told me to read it again. And, you know, I ended up just reading the doctor's opinion for the last 12 days I was in treatment. But what happened was I started to learn, you know, I finally started to learn about my alcoholism, you know, because getting here, I had no idea what that actually meant. You know, I had no idea that, you know, so there's a part in the doctor's opinion where it talks about, you know, it's talking about the allergy, obviously. And, you know, it goes on to say this, speaking about the allergy, this explains things that we otherwise can't account for. And I remember I was reading it probably for the sixth time, because I'm super quick. And it just hit me. Other things I can't account for. Like, I had been spent so much time searching for the answer of, like, what had happened? Why am I like this? You know, why do I, you know, I love my mom. Why do I keep hurting her? Why do I go in her pocketbook every time I get a chance? I love my sister, but I freak out on her all the time when she gets in my way. You know, it's like all these things that make no sense and I don't want to do. You know, it's like I finally got my answer there. And from that point forward, I could start to make a beginning. You know, I struggle, you know, I struggled in a way with the God thing getting here. You know, I had a God in my life as a kid. My problem when I got here was that, you know, I wholeheartedly believe that God had, you know, God might be looking out for you guys, but he clearly wasn't looking out for me. You know, it wasn't that I believed nothing was there. It was that God didn't give a shit about me, and he probably had every reason not to at this point. So I remember, I was, you know, so when I got here, I got plugged in, and honestly, I felt like happy for a little bit, you know, a lot of people share and they talk about how immediately it sucked and it was terrible. For me, it was kind of the opposite, and I felt like I fit and I had kind of found a place that I belonged. But then, you know, 2 months go by and, I get complacent and everything starts to suck again. And I start, you know, controlling the situation. And I remember one day I was at a meeting. It was noon, you know, because that's what I did. I rode my bicycle to a noontime meeting every single day. And I'm complaining about my life. And this guy came up to me after the meeting and he said, "It sounds like you need a job." And I said, "That would be fantastic." And he said, "All right, I'll have one of my guys pick you up at 6 a.m. tomorrow and drive you, you know, to the job site." And I said, "Cool." So that guy shows up. He picks me up. We start driving over there. How much time do I have? I'm really doing a bad time managing this. And we drive over to the job site. Again, I'm in an area I don't know. I don't really recognize. But as we're driving, I start to see things that I knew. And it became obvious we're getting close to the rehab that I had just got out of. And we're pulling up to it, and I'm like, I don't know what we're doing here. Maybe we're picking up someone else for work because they hire guys like me. And we pull in, and I ask the guy, I'm like, you know, what are we doing here? And he said, "Well, you're at work. We're here to work." I said, "What do you mean?" He said, "You know, we're going to replace every single window in this facility." And I remember at the moment, like, immediately just being like, holy shit, you know, I'm going to be working at this place, you know, for the next however long, you know, that saved my life. And, you know, it was undeniable at that point. And I share that story because that was the first of these undeniable God moments that I've had over the last 11 years. You know, it's like from that point on, I couldn't fight it anymore. I couldn't fight that something was working here. I couldn't fight that, you know, I wasn't pulling the strings as much as I thought I was. You know, that something might have been working for me and not against me. And once I started to open my eyes for that, life got a lot easier. You know, once I was able to be open-minded to that, to see that, just a little bit, it was like immediately my life started to get simpler, less of a fight. So yeah, you know, I did a fourth step with that guy. I did a fifth step with that guy. I did, you know, my first amends wasn't, I think you said with the sober house, maybe. Yeah. No, mine was with a security guard at the place that I was living, though, because she wouldn't let me in one night. I freaked out. She called the cops. She called. Yeah. So, yeah. So life got better, you know. You guys taught me how to get a job, how to do my laundry, all those things. Like I said, I was a kid when I got here that didn't know how to do anything. You guys taught me how to pay bills. I got my license back when I was a couple years sober. Haven't lost it since. I did find out just a few months ago, though, that it's still under probation, which is insane. I haven't got a ticket or anything. So there's that. But yeah, you know, so I don't know. I've really rambled on here, and you know, I feel like 30 minutes should be longer than it feels. But you know, I moved back here when I was about 2 years sober. And quickly, I'll try to quickly share another cool little God moment with you guys. Is I moved up here, and you know, I was 2 years sober, and I was super plugged in down there, and I got that ego, you know. I'd show up to meetings. I knew everybody. Guys were asking me to sponsor them. You know, I started to think I had all the answers. And I got up here and no one knew me. And no one, you know, not that no one gave a shit because they wanted to know me if I would have put my hand out. But, you know, no one gave a shit. And, you know, and I started to get in my feelings. I had a hard time getting plugged in because I wasn't putting my hand out. You know, and I'd say you guys weren't welcoming to me. But the truth is I didn't do anything to be welcome. So I was up here for a couple months and I got a call from a friend, you know, one of my best friends from high school times. And, he told me he had just went into treatment. I was like, that's awesome, man. You know, I just got back here. I'll come and see you. So I did, I went and saw him. They started letting me take him out and we started going to meetings and it was like, you know, God's plan became very clear. Like, you know, it's my time to move back here. Travis is here. I need to get him plugged in. I'm going to be useful to him. So that's what we did. We went to a million meetings. We got involved with NekiPaw. We did all the things. We drove all around New England. And the next year and a half was unbelievable. You know, long story short, Travis didn't stay sober. I did. You know, I was driving home from a hockey game a couple months after he went out, and I got a phone call from a buddy saying, hey, have you heard about Travis? I said, no. And, you know, long story short, someone found him in a, you know, a public restroom, overdosed. And I remember for the first time really since I got sober being, you know, like, what is going on here, God? You know, you're supposed to take care of me. You're supposed to take care of us. What is happening? You know, I'm being angry. You know, and as time went, it started to become clear to me what the plan there was. And I've had similar experiences along the way. And the plan was that, you know, I stayed sober. Maybe Travis came around to keep me going instead of the other way around. You know, it's like sometimes I think I'm being a vessel, and maybe I am in a lot of ways, but, you know, it's also working in reverse. So, yeah, you know, my life, I've definitely gone over my time because I got the 1 minute warning probably 2 minutes ago. But, you know, my life is good today, and it's taken a lot of turns that I wouldn't have, you know, mapped it out. But it is definitely nothing that I would have expected to happen to me, you know, 12 years ago. You know, I'm employable. I got a great job. You know, I've got a home. I've got a great girlfriend and two beautiful kids. And, you know, I have so many people that I love and that love me. And that is the number one thing that, you know, I love about Alcoholics Anonymous. I have formed relationships here that I've never found outside of here, and I don't know anyone that has, you know. So I am indebted to Alcoholics Anonymous, and I'm sorry if I rambled and if that was a disaster. I heard a few laughs, though, so at least you got that. But yeah, I'm grateful to be here with you guys, and thank you for having me.
Thank you, Kanan. We encourage all attendees to participate fully in our meetings and to have a service position. If you would like to be of service, please see our jobs coordinator, Ramiro, after the meeting. Thank you. Now we have Mike and Angelica for festivities.
Just me.